If I were to pass a piece of paper around and ask you to write on it the one chapter that you believe is the most ignored chapter in all of the Bible, I suspect that we would get a variety of answers to that. And no doubt some would be the same, but still I'm confident that in a group of this many people that there'd be a lot of opinions about which chapter gets ignored the most. I suspect that some of you might agree with my entry on that piece of paper, that it would be Matthew chapter 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. To Abraham was born Isaac, to Isaac, Jacob. To Jacob, Judah and his brothers. To Judah were born Perez and Zerah by Tamar. To Perez was born Hezron, and Hezron Ram. And to Ram was born Amminadab. And to Amminadab, that's why it gets ignored, you know. Nashon, and to Nashon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz by Rahab. And to Boaz was born Obed by Ruth, and to Obed Jesse. And to Jesse was born David the king. And to David was born Solomon by her who had been the wife of Uriah. And some of you are thinking already, surely he's not going to read the whole chapter. It's just a bunch of names. And for that reason, it oftentimes gets overlooked and ignored. If you read from the King James Version, it reads something more like, and Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judah and his brothers. Preacher said one time, this was one of my preachers, you know, from back where I come from, said, Abraham forgot Isaac, and Isaac forgot Jacob, and Jacob forgot Judah. And then his comment on the chapter was, they were the forgettingest bunch of people I ever heard of. But it can become a somewhat of a weariness to read lists of names like that. And it's easy to conclude that there just isn't much of value in a passage such as this. But then when you come over to the 22nd verse of the chapter, Matthew says, now all this took place that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child, shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. Verse 22 tells us why this chapter is in the Bible. It tells us why Matthew began his gospel account of Jesus' life with this listing of the family heritage, the family tree of Jesus. He says that it was to record all that had taken place. He says that this all took place, that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, referring to what Isaiah says in chapter 7 and verse 14 of the book of Isaiah about the birth of a child to a virgin being a son to God's people. Now, Matthew traces this genealogy through the supposed father of Jesus, that is Joseph. And he traces this genealogy all the way back to Abraham, to the premier name in the history of the people of Israel. There's a parallel passage to this in the book of Luke, in the third chapter. That is, that Luke provides a genealogy of Jesus. But it's different. And it is supposed by many that it is different because Luke is tracing the genealogy of Jesus through Mary, as opposed to through the supposed father of Jesus, that is Joseph. The reason for tracing the genealogy through Joseph was because that was the legal means of establishing in the Jews, or to the Jews, that was the legal means of establishing the descendancy of someone. And we see that as he traces that genealogy back through Joseph, it goes back through David, as we read. Luke records the genealogy of Jesus, presumably through Mary, and does that tracing the heritage of Jesus not just to Abraham, not just to Adam, but to God Himself. Thus showing that Jesus was both what He claimed to be, the Son of Man, as well as the Son of God. But Matthew's account is declared, I believe, explained by Matthew himself as being recorded in order to make this point that Jesus' birth was the fulfillment of prophecy. The promise that had been made to Abraham many centuries before, recorded first in the book of Genesis, chapter 12, was that God was going to make of him a great nation. He was going to provide a land for that nation of people to live in. And then from that nation, He was going to bless all the nations of the earth. That through Abraham's seed, and the Lord used a singular form there, seed, that through Abraham's seed, all nations of the earth was going to be would be blessed. And He repeats it again in the 15th chapter when He talks to Abraham once more about this promise. He reiterates it to Abraham's son Isaac and then to Abraham's grandson Jacob, repeating again this intention that through the descendants of Abraham, all of the nations of the earth would be blessed. The Apostle Paul makes reference to this in the third chapter of Galatians. And he says in Galatians chapter 3 that the Lord spoke this to Abraham and said to him that in your seed, and Paul makes the point based upon that singular form of the word, he says in Galatians 3, not to seeds as to many, but one seed. That being, Paul says, Jesus Christ. That Jesus was going to be the fulfillment of this promise and the prophetic declarations made by Isaiah and others were going to be fulfilled in what we read about in this opening of Matthew chapter 1. Did you know that the genealogies of the Jews were obliterated? They were destroyed, essentially, at the destruction of the nation of Israel in AD 70. So the Jews certainly can trace their heritage to being Jews. They can show that they are descendants of Abraham, that they are of the Jewish nation. But they cannot trace their heritage to the tribe of their family. And that's significant because that just means that the nation of Israel, as it was constituted in the Old Testament and in the opening pages of the New Testament, or throughout most of the New Testament, that the nation of Israel, as it was constituted in the Bible, simply cannot be reconstructed. You cannot establish a tribe of Judah or a tribe of Levi from which you could have priests. That happened around 70 AD. The destruction of these genealogical tables that the Jews had. So what that means is, if you dismiss, for instance, Jesus of Nazareth as the Messiah, what this means is you can't establish who the Messiah would be if one were to come in the future. For the Messiah was said to be one who would be a descendant of David. He would have to be of the tribe of Judah, therefore. But there's no way that one could establish that. Now, Jesus could. And it was established in the text that we're looking at in Matthew chapter 1. So genealogies are important. They're important not just to historical interest. They're important not just to Jews. They're important to any who would read the Bible and study it and consider what it declares about who Jesus is. They're important to establishing the identity of Jesus. Now, with all of that said, so is there anything else of value in a text such as this? Well, I would say that would be enough to establish its value. But it seems to me that there's some value as well in who we read about in this list. I mean, these are some very notable names, some more so than others. But as you study the Old Testament scriptures and you read about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and David the king and others that are identified here, Boaz, it becomes valuable to see the role that these people who formed the human family of Jesus, to see what they did, how they lived, and to learn something about their lives. Well, I want this evening for just a few moments to direct your attention to four of these people. And I'm calling this lesson the four mothers of Jesus. Because there are in this list four women who are identified. Now, everybody who's mentioned in this list had a mother. So why are these four picked out? Well, I want to suggest to you some thoughts about that as we come to the close of this lesson. But I want you to think about these four women who were mentioned. They are Tamar, mentioned in verse 3, Rahab, and Ruth, both mentioned in verse 5. And then Bathsheba, mentioned in verse 6, though not by name. She's simply identified as her who had been the wife of Uriah. Interestingly enough, these four women, three are described to us in scriptures as being sinful women. I mean, there were periods of their life that are described in the Old Testament scriptures, involved activities that were wrong. And we'll take a note of how grievous some of their wrongdoings were. But it's interesting also to note, I think, that at least two of these women were Gentiles. Maybe three, but two, certainly. Ruth is a Moabitess, and Rahab was a woman who lived in Jericho before the Jews came to conquer the promised land and destroyed Jericho. Those two women unquestionably were Gentiles. They were non-Jews. It's possible, and the suggestion is made by some, that Bathsheba was a Gentile as well. Her husband, Uriah, was a Hittite. And so the suggestion by some is she possibly was herself. And that may be so. But it only falls within the realm of a possibility. It might be noted from looking at that from another standpoint is she's never identified as a Hittite. These other women, Rahab and Ruth, are clearly identified as being Gentile women. And so The other suggestion is, well, the fact that she's not specifically identified as a Gentile woman like Ruth and Rahab were identified would suggest that she was not a Gentile. Had she been a Gentile, it would have been more likely that it would have been acknowledged that she was. Possibly so. All we can say is that it falls within the realm of possibility, either way. Tamar is the only woman of these four who is a Jew. So what's the meaning in all of this? Why is this of any significance? Well, there are a couple of suggestions I would make to you of possible significance to why these four women are mentioned. Before I do that, though, I want you to think with me about these four women. A little bit more about their stories. Bathsheba, everybody knows. Everybody knows what Bathsheba did. And some might say, oh, well, now you're just being unfair, David. Really, it was David who did it. And that's true. David, what David did was wrong. But let me tell you, Bathsheba went to him when he sent for her. Oh, what she did was wrong. Then there's also mentioned the woman Rahab, a resident of Jericho, when the Jews came and conquered the city, and identified in the scriptures as being Rahab the harlot. I'll tell you a little story about that. When our daughter Katie was pretty small, she was in Bible class, and one of the men was teaching the class, so she wasn't real little. You know, men won't teach the real little ones. So she was a little bit older. But he was teaching this Bible class, and they were talking about Jericho and Rahab the harlot. And finally, a point came in the class where the teacher kind of paused, and Katie said, "What is a harlot?" And he said, "Katie, you just go ask your mother about that." Well, I think most of us would know. And we know what that means about that woman's past. Then there is the woman Ruth, who is, by all accounts, and as we read in the book that bears her name, a wonderful woman, a woman of great character. There's just very little that you could say against Ruth. But she is clearly identified as being a woman who was outside of the commonwealth of Israel. She was a stranger to God. She was a woman of the Moabite nation. Now, she obviously became a woman who became a worshiper of God. Remember what she said to Naomi, her mother-in-law, that I'll go where you go. Your God will be my God. Your people will be my people. Now, it's a great passage that's often used in marriage ceremonies. What we need to remember is it was said by a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law, declaring her allegiance to her mother-in-law and her willingness to abide with her. And then there is Tamar, probably the woman of these four that we know the least about. But Genesis chapter 38 tells us her story, and it's a sordid story. She was married to one of the sons of Judah, who was an evil man, her husband. So evil that God killed him. And then according to the Jewish law, the practice, the practice of the Jews, it was determined that she would be the second son's wife, and that she would have children by him and have an inheritance as a result of that. But the second son did not want to have children. Not with her. And so he dies. And Judah says to Tamar, "Now you wait, and when my youngest son becomes old enough, he'll take you as his wife." And when he came of age, Judah didn't keep his word. And so Tamar, in, as I said, a sordid scheme, determined that she would deceive her father-in-law, Judah. And so she dressed herself as a harlot. And she lured him into sexual relations so that she might have children by him. And that's why when you read here in Matthew's account, that he says that to Judah were born Perez and Zerah by Tamar. It's a terrible story. It's a terrible background. Why? Why these four? Well, one suggestion that I would make to you is that it's possible that this is indicative of the new age in Christ, where there would no longer be this distinction between Jew and Greek, but male and female, bond and free, and so forth. But there is this to be this universal kingdom ruled over by this King, Jesus, who has come to us with this heritage, this distinctly different makeup of people in his background. Another suggestion that is made is that this may be a foreshadowing of the graciousness of Jesus, that even sinners can be brought to him. You remember the things that his critics said during his public preaching? They asked his disciples, "Why does your master receive sinners? This man receives sinners. Aren't you glad of it?" Look at the background that we have in his genealogy. As I said, some indicate or some suggest that this is an indication of this new age when Christ would come and there would no longer be this distinction between Jew and Greek, and that it's an indication of a breaking down of these barriers. I'm not sure if that's what's involved here. But let me ask you to think about this. Why in Jesus' stories and his illustrations and his parables, why were the Samaritans so often the heroes of the story? You remember this parable of the Good Samaritan? Why was that so? I think probably most people would say, well, Jesus is making a point. He's making a point that these people who are repugnant in the eyes of the Jews are noble people. They can be noble people. They can be spoken of as being these heroes in the stories. When people like the Levite and the priest from among the Jews were the ones who failed so miserably to do what was right. I think many times we might look at the things that Jesus said when he spoke in parables, and he spoke so favorably about the Samaritans, that we oftentimes conclude, well, he's making a point by that. Well, it may very well be that that's the reason that the Spirit inspired Matthew in his writing of this text to speak of these four women, instead of talking about the others that he could have spoken of. Could have talked about Sarah. Could have talked about many other godly women in this line of descendancy of the Lord. But for some reason, he picked out these four. And it was perhaps to make this point. Now, I know for certain, that what verse 22 says is that these things were written in order to record the facts of what took place that had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, that that might be fulfilled. I know that Matthew wrote these things for that purpose. And it ought to impress upon us the significance of fulfilled prophecy in identifying Jesus as the Messiah. He meets in every respect, every characteristic that God inspired prophets of old to speak about regarding the Messiah who would come. It may very well hold these other valuable lessons to us as well. There were many godly women in the life of Jesus. We read in the gospel accounts of good women who, from their possessions, supported Jesus financially. You know, his going around the countryside preaching and teaching people wasn't done without cost. It wasn't done without sacrifice. It wasn't done easily always. And what the scriptures tell us is that among those that made this possible, among those that joined with the Lord in proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom as he did, among those were good and godly women. But this is also a text that would teach us a much needed lesson. And that is that people who have sometimes made just miserable messes of their life can yet be used by the Lord. They can turn their life around. I don't know, really, much of what happened in the life of Tamar after that sordid story that we read about in Genesis 38. I do know a little bit more about the life of Ruth, Rahab, how these were women who illustrated that one can turn to God and be used of Him and be a valuable asset to Him and to His cause. It's a good lesson for you and for me. It's exactly the lesson the Apostle Paul taught in 1 Timothy chapter 1 when he spoke of his own life and the mess that he had made of it. All in good conscience, all convinced that what he was doing was right, but nonetheless being devoted to opposition of the Lord's cause. But nonetheless, he says, I obtained mercy. And he makes the point that this was done so that others might learn that if the Lord would be merciful to him, he would be merciful to any who would seek that mercy. And so from these four foremothers of Jesus, at the very least, learn that message. That if you've made a miserable mess in your life, it can be straightened out. You can be made right with God. And you can be put to useful service in His kingdom if you will but come to Him. And that can only be done through that Son who descended through these four women. If you believe Jesus is indeed the Son of God, and you would turn from your life of sin, confess your faith in Him, and be baptized, washing the guilt of those sins away, and then live a life serving Him faithfully, whatever you may have done in the past, there can be nothing but great things in the future for you. if you'll devote your life from now on to Him. We pray you'll do that while we stand and sing.